one of our most serious writers, Jim McDowell. Jim, good morning.
Good morning, you, Frank.
Jim, you're at it again. I've read the Sunday World for long and many a day, and that front page, you always seem to be at war with some paramilitary grouping or other. You've now put all this risk-taking that you've spent your life involved in book form.
Well, I have, Frank. It's there was two other old books that I did. One was 16 years ago, and I dedicated that book to Martin O'Hagan, who was murdered 16 years ago, and still no justice for Martin. His anniversary's next week, actually. But this week is 28th of September. But no, a couple of other books that I've done, Frank, and I'm from the gasworks just across the road from
you. The Shugrees, didn't you?
Did the Shugrees, Mummy's Boys, they went well, but I just wanted to do stories of my life. I started as a cub reporter in a newsletter way back in 1969, Frank, and now I've been a pencil pusher ever since. I'm not a journalist. Journalists are people who write things that they expect other people to respect.
Yes,
we
but
write
the thing
stories
I wanna,
and let the punters make up their minds.
The thing I want to emphasise before you tell me your life story is you're a risk taker. You lost Martin. Martin mm-hmm. worked with you. Martin, I'm proud to say Martin was a friend of mine as well. What a nice man. He was murdered. He was murdered in cold blood on the street in Lurgan. You had no problem whatsoever writing about people who were close to the killing. You had no problem whatsoever writing about terrorists, about drugs dealers, and putting yourself at risk. That's the sort of individual you are. Now, you say you started in the gasworks or close to the gasworks growing up, just a spit away from here, and you became the person you became. But did you never have any fear?
Oh, no. Anybody, Frank, who says that they never experience fear is a fool. As simple as that. Look, newspapers and journalists in this city, in this country, Frank, we weren't the blow-ins. We weren't the people who came in after the latest atrocity, stayed for 4 days until the reaction subsided and then went away again. We were part of this community. The staff of the Sunday World grew up in this community, have children growing up in this community. Belfast Telegraph, Irish News, Newsletter, any newspaper you want to name. And we were endemic with this problem. It wasn't as if we were in and out. We had to live with it. We had to live with the threats. We had to live with Martin being murdered. We had to live with me being given the kicking at the outside the City Hall by a UVF mob. But you live with that. But it's because you believe in your community. You're part of your community. You've got that embrace. And people now say, Frank, you know, that one side or the other won the war, and security forces won the war. The ordinary, decent people, the honest people of this country won the war whenever they said, we have had enough. Not that they ever wanted it, but it was foisted upon them. And then on that big, big telephone pole, I forget what year it was, Frank, where British Telecom cooperated with both the Newsletter and the Irish News, I'd met some people before to set it up. And I thought that the two papers representing each side of the community should actually run this poll. And in 24 hours, Frank, just with the single slug, the single slogan, stop the killing, 158,000 people phoned up, and you didn't have to say anything, you pressed a button. And I think that was a watershed, Frank. That's when the people, the ordinary people, really got their chance to say, stop the killing, outside of the to and fro of politics. And 158,000 in 24 hours, that was some reaction, Frank. And it's just that you are... Everybody became sick of it, Frank. And all you were doing in exposing the gangsters, the paramilitaries, the terrorists, the IRA, INLA, UVF, UDA, I don't care what they were. They were parasites living off their own community and killing members of their own community. It was working class people who were being murdered, Frank, you know, and it was happening half a mile from each other. If you look at the proximity of the Shankill Road and the Falls Road and the bomb runs that went between the two and the murders and the shootings, it was almost neighbours killing each other. So it had to stop, and that's part of what a newspaper does.
But you were very much part of a newspaper that, correct me if I'm wrong, but I can. Jim Campbell was also
right,
injured. He was an editor of the newspaper
on his own doorstep. Yeah.
Martin was killed. You were regularly targeted, and you were beaten up. Was there never a time during it where, even in the office at the newspapers, you thought to yourself, maybe we should just ease back a wee bit? Because every Sunday seemed to be a row where you were more or less exposing people, using nicknames and whatever, but you were taunting them to some extent.
No, it wasn't a matter of taunting them. I do use the word expose. And I mean, I've met most of them, Frank. I mean, they demanded to see. I mean, I sat down face to face across a table, even closer than you, with Billy Wright. King Rat, that he was kicked out of the UVF and went on to form the Loyalist Volunteer Force round Lurgan, round Mid-Ulster. And, I mean, sitting down with him, with Swinger Fulton, they're both now dead, Swinger Fulton is his minder sitting beside him and being told he's going to shoot me, he's going to shoot every member of my staff, kill every member of my staff, he's going to target anybody who delivers the newspapers, he's going to target news agents, he's going to target advertising people. I mean, when you're sitting with someone like that, who's not only a psychopath, but a sociopath, when you're sitting face to face with that, and on the other side, Hugh Tourney, he's dead now as well. He wanted to see me, and I went to see him, because if you didn't go to see him, you didn't know what was going to happen. At least you were being told directly to your face. And I mean, he produced a gun, put it down the hill, and said to me that he wasn't going to shoot me, he was going to shoot one of my reporters. Now, I live with that.
When you go back to the office then, and you say that that's where you've been, that's who you've been talking to, you then put the front page story up where you're referring to these guys by the nicknames. Were these nicknames in the community, or were these nicknames that you gave them to make them to belittle them?
Mainly they were in the community. Mainly that they were spawned probably in the school playground. But you mentioned staff there. I will say this, that we had a brilliant team, still have, in the Sunday World, Frank. I put all the cards on the tables. We got threats or whatever. We had meetings. We sat it down there, and not one person ever asked me to back off, or not one person ever wanted to back off. As I say, they were part of the community. They wanted to expose this. They wanted
not
to
even
stop.
When Martin got murdered.
No, an absolute show of 9,000% solidarity. The people come up from London. I could tell you about what happened afterwards and how Martin's dear widow Mary was treated by Tony O'Reilly, was a proprietor of the paper then. His son Gavin O'Reilly came up. Michael Brophy was the managing director. Colin McGinty is still the editor. No. Those people come up from Dublin, and they looked after that family immaculately well. And the day of the funeral was, I've said before, you could bite tension.
I remember it.
Yes, Frank. I really expected another attack on the funeral that day. I was last out of Martin's house and Mary's house to close the lock on the door, to lock the door behind them. I then joined the cortege. It was a short walk to the cemetery, but even the police had said that day, you know, there's a real possibility of something here. Like, you remember the barrack bomb attacks or a hand grenade over a hedge or whatever. And you could really bite the tension that day, but no, it didn't deter anyone. Everyone was there, 100% loyalty and determination that we would mourn for Martin, but we would keep on in the tradition of reporting of investigative journalism that he did. And I mean, we talked about Billy Wright there. I only found out about this afterwards. Billy Wright would go, you know, on a kind of evangelical thrust where he was a Bible thumper, and then he'd be into drugs himself and selling drugs. But he said it was no biblical vengeance threat. I've learned out later that he said if anything ever happened to him, it was to happen to Martin O'Hagan tenfold. Well, when Billy Wright was killed in the jail by Crip McWilliams, the INLA, murdered him inside the jail, Martin's assassination followed after that. And as I said to you at the start, Frank, I mean, we're now 28th of September. What's that? This Thursday is the 16th anniversary of Martin's murder. There's still been no justice for Martin. There's been nobody in court. There's been nobody convicted. There's nobody behind bars. Now, if that had happened to a journalist in Glasgow or London, well, it happened in Dublin. And look at the huge difference, the dispatch with which the Garda Síochána and the authorities got there, got Veronica Gerrans, the Sunday Independent journalist who was gunned down in similar fashion, drive-by killing. If you look at the contrast, the difference in the time it took them to get her killers behind bars, and we're still waiting for justice for Martin. There's something wrong somewhere, Frank.
You say that you didn't taunt them with the way you wrote about them in the paper. You were exposing them. Did it work? Was it worth it week in, week out? Because you're bound to have been lived with fear. I know you had protective bulletproof glass and whatever on your house. You had threats coming. The PS and I were delivering threats to you even up until recently. So was it worth it from a lifestyle perspective to be Jim McDowell from the Donegal Pass the whole way through your life looking over your shoulder?
Frank, I think the last line in the book says it was a dangerous job. It was a job that really exercised you to the limit. The great thing was that I had Lindy, who was a journalist as well, as you know, and she understood and she supported it. I mean, she wasn't behind the eight ball and taking a swipe at the terrorists in her Belfast Telegraph column as well. But no, I think that the thing was, Frank, you know, that newspaper readership structures are A, B, C, D. A is the kind of professionals who read the Daily Telegraph, the London Times, the Irish Times, whatever. Well, we were B minus C, D. We were selling into the housing estates, into the so-called ghettos, Frank, and it was those people that really appreciated us. The number of phone calls, I mean, they were our best contacts. You can't take my name, I can't give you my name, but here's what happened last night. And I'd like to meet you somewhere, but I can't be seen with you in public. So they drop a note through the door, but they phone you up previously, then they drop something anonymously through the office door, or they'd leave it somewhere for you to pick up. That was the kind of information. It was the terror gangs who had the jackboot of fascism on the neck of those people, and it was those people who were buying the paper in bulk. And, you know, it became the biggest selling paper in Northern Ireland, but just because we were in pursuit of these people and people wanted to know what was happening. But no, I think the final sentence in the book was, you know, there were rough times, there were tough times, seriously bad times, but, you know, it was the best job in the world, with a capital W, the Sunday World, and I wouldn't swap it. I would not swap it for anything.
Now, the book is The Good Fight, 45 years face-to-face with terrorism or terrorists, and you've spent so much of your time. You've done other stories as well. You've done the lighter stuff. You've done the exposés and lots of other material as a Sunday World Northern editor. You're no longer the editor of the paper, but you can't let it go. You're still campaigning against the drugs dealers, against the paramilitary groups. Will you do this until there is no more, Jim McDowell?
Well, yes, I will. I've no intention. I mean, I use the word. I'm supposed to have retired, 15 months ago or something. Frank, whenever I stood down there in that high court and we were being done for harassment, invasion of privacy of the bogeyman, or they reckoned that what we were writing about them was a threat to their life under the European Human Rights Act, which unfortunately is a gagging mechanism for newspapers or broadcasters. We've fought a load of cases and won. These guys, the terrorists, the gangsters, are getting our money, public money, through legal aid to stop newspapers and broadcasters writing and exposing them. But the minutes of time I stood in front of a judge down in that high court and I said, "My lud, what we said in the paper, we used the word alleged. We didn't make it as a statement of fact. So I'm allegedly retired. And yes, I'm still in the front studs. I'm an old rugby man. It's never look back, never step back, stay in the front studs, and that's the way it's going to be."
Yeah, you're very much a rugby man, aren't you?
Oh, I love the game. Rugby's kind of my religion. But yeah, I played rugby for 37 years, from I was 11 until I was 48. I was still pockling for the old Malone Tankers team, Craigie Red Sox. We don't call ourselves Malone Rugby Club. We're the Craigie Road Red Sox. So on CI, come in your mouth shouting, I played a bit for them. But The thing that stopped me, Frank, and it's just as well, was the helicopter accident. Because when I came down in the helicopter and busted my back, I would still have kept on playing it. I died of a heart attack, chasing a bag of wind.
And then include that story in the book about the helicopter?
You were on a
jolly that day, weren't
That's
you?
That's right. We were up with Guinness. Guinness had given us our flying jackets. But, I mean, I still describe it in the book as the most wonderful example of the celebration of the human spirit, because we were up there for 2 minutes and 36 seconds and we were spiralling about. There was no tail rotor on the chopper, and we put our arms around each other, and nobody mentioned dying. Everybody was saying, "We're going to get out of this, we're going to walk away." And Barbara McCann, the great broadcaster who works in here now in Havelock House, Barbara said the most unselfish thing I've ever heard, because she was sitting in the middle of me and Big Joe Kearney from the Irish News, and in the back of the small helicopter. And when the pilot switched off the main rotor so we could have a dead drop and jettisoned the fuel at about 500 feet, Malcolm Reeves was the pilot, saved all our lives. Hero, he broke his back in two places when we hit the deck. But Barbara said the most unselfish thing. She was a single woman. And she said a wee prayer. She said, "Dear Jesus, please look after my mother and father." And that's who she was thinking about, not herself. We were all thinking about our families. But that just, we knew then, after Barbara said that, we were going to be okay. we weren't going to, we're going to get hurt, but we're going to be okay. But it was the most beautiful, beautiful thing to say.
Do you believe? Do you believe in God, Jim?
Kind of.
You believed in him at that moment?
Well, look, as I say, Barbara said a wee prayer, but I believe, Frank, in what I said there, the human spirit, the soul of human beings, as well as a bit of religion. I mean, I tell you God's honest truth, and I said that one night at a meeting of humanists. They asked me to be a guest speaker, and I said, I'll tell you the God's honest truth. And they all looked at me and said, why are you saying that? But after Martin's, the Sunday after we buried Martin on the Friday, there's a great big canon up in Beaver Parish Church, Church of Ireland up there in Beaver, and he's called the loosest canon in the Church of Ireland, but he's a smashing man. The sermons are absolutely brilliant. But I went to his church. He stopped the service whenever I walked in. I was completely wrecked. I hadn't slept for 3 nights. I was completely wrecked. And he says, there's Big Madolin. He says, we're stopping the service now, and we're going to say a prayer, not for Big Madol, but for Marie O'Hagan, for Martin O'Hagan and for Mary O'Hagan, and for their 3 daughters. And that was the most wonderful thing as well. So when you've got somebody like Big Tom Keatley, who is a representative of God, he doesn't call it Beaver Parish Church, he calls it God's Church. That's who owns it. But when you get somebody like that, that makes you believe. Even the wee iota, that makes you believe.
It's an interesting commentary, Jim, and I'm sure it's a very, very interesting book, The Good Fight, 40 Years Face-to-Face with Terrorism. It's available now, publisher?
It's in the bookshops, Frank. It's being launched tomorrow night.